screen anarchy called Hokum, a nonstop fright factory, and I can vouch for that. I've seen it, I love it, and now it's available on digital. From Damian McCarthy, director of Oddity, Hokum stars Adam Scott in a profoundly terrifying horror film, said The Rap. When reclusive novelist Ohm Bauman retreats to a remote Irish inn to scatter his parents' ashes, the staff's tales of an ancient witch haunting the honeymoon suite take hold of his mind. Soon, disturbing visions and shocking disappearances draw him into a nightmarish confrontation with the darkest corners of his past. Slash Film called Hokum a straight-up horror thrill ride, and Fangoria, hey, I've heard of those guys, noted that it is scary enough to make seasoned viewers jump. Experience Hokum everywhere you rent or buy movies right now. And speaking of Fangoria, did you know they have been at it for over 40 years, and they are better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year. Each issue is filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up, and if you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you will save an astronomical 25% off of your order. That is Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. And now, let's get on with the show, shall we?
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Welcome back to the KINGCAST. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And I'm Eric Vespi.
Eric, we are headed today to Widow's Bay, a series on Apple TV I cannot get enough of. And listen, man, we have had some legends on this show. But today we have Mr. Stephen Root, who is someone who, if you take any one of his most memorable roles, any one of them would make him beloved. You could start anywhere. Bill Dotrieve on King of the Hill, Jimmy James on News Radio, Fuchs in Barry, Milton Wadhams, the guy with the red stapler in Office Space. Stephen was the man in the high castle in The Man in the High Castle.
High Castle.
any one of those would be career definers for an actor, but you
I'm
can't
a legend
just
in my own mind
exactly. but you can't just say, "Oh, you know Stephen Root from," because you know him from everything. He was in Get Out, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, The Men Who Stare at Goats, Finding Nemo. The list goes on and on. We get a heaping helping of him as a grizzled New England fisherman named Wick, who knows all the secrets of an extremely cursed island in Widow's Bay. And the show is scary. It's hilarious. It is intense. Stephen Root brings all of that and then some. I'm going to stop blowing smoke now and just say, welcome to
Thank
the KINGCAST, Mr. Root.
Hey, happy to be with you guys. Absolutely.
And I also have to jump in real quick as somebody who's lived in Austin, Texas since the early 90s. Office Space holds such a place in my heart as a reflection. And I watch it in a way that I don't think a lot of people do. But when you were in Austin in that time, because it was shot in Austin, that becomes a time capsule, that movie, of exactly what that was. My dad was in tech. He probably worked at a place like in a tech. His was called Unison Software, right? and visiting him and like just every time I watch that movie, I flash back to that era in Austin, which isn't an era that exists anymore. So in a weird way, your movie hits everybody and, you know, in a nostalgia center just because it's, you know, it's so funny and everybody remembers the first time they've seen it.
Well, everybody remembers those computers, you know, and when you see the movie, I mean, it's still people in cubicles and that still exists. So I think it still resonates pretty much with everybody.
It's unchanged. Yes, it's still forever relevant.
But yeah, it Austin is so great. I mean, I've worked down there. I just went down there and worked for a local director named Bob Byington. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know Bob, mm-hmm. but did a couple of movies with him. If you haven't seen Infinity Baby, you should.
Great.
That's a great Bob Byington movie. But I went down there and did another another one for him. And I just love going down there, but it's just so huge now compared to what it was when we did Office Space, you know?
Yeah.
But gorgeous, gorgeous place to go. Still not many people there.
And the movie becomes oddly prophetic, not to get all political now, but we're starting to get people who fed up employees setting their employees building on fire now.
Not as prophetic as Idiocracy.
Jesus. Yeah.
That's happening now. Buildings are falling over because dumb people are in charge. It's just very bizarre.
You know, I'm in Idiocracy for a hot second.
Are you?
Yeah, did a little extra work down at the old Austin Convention Center.
No kidding.
While it's Andrew Wilson, right? What's his name? The lead? It's Luke.
Oh no, no. Dax Shepard.
No. He's a Wilson brother. He is one of the Wilsons. Luke Wilson. Right. So I'm behind him whenever he's taking his. IQ test in there, and they had me dress up in those those nylon things that are all the costumes are made of coupons, so they're like nylon biker kind of stuff, and but they were actually up close. They're all made of coupons, so you can get the butt fucker coupon or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Mike, that was the first year that Crocs came out, and Mike said, "Yeah, let's use these. These are weird looking." He had everybody in the future wearing Crocs.
Yep.
I think Idiocracy has perhaps your greatest hairstyle in a movie, Stephen. What do you think?
That's true. It's close to Weapon X, I think.
Yeah, a little Wolverine, right?
Yeah.
Sort of a cross between Wolverine and like a founding father.
Yeah, no, I took the prop I took from that was the enormous gavel. So I have that at home. I have that at home anyway.
You know, I'm kicking myself because, you know, they do local prop sales and stuff from time to time, right?
Yeah.
And I went to one that the local film society put on, not thinking I'd see anything, and they had President Camacho's desk for sale there. It was like $500 or something, which is nothing for what it should be, because it has the big presidential seal, and I think it had, you know, Terry Crews's face like all over
cool.
it. I'm like, this is the funniest thing to make this your desk, but I was not in a position where I could drop $500 on a prop.
Man, all this talk is making me thirsty for Brondo. I could use some electrolytes.
God.
It's what plants crave, yes, for sure.
Better than water. Yeah.
Stephen, while watching Widow's Bay, I'm thinking this is a show that it's, as I said, a scary story. It's part of it's like a small town horror story like Salem's Lot or something like that, where there's a curse or like John Carpenter's The Fog.
Yeah.
Definitely elements of that, I think.
All that's in there. Absolutely.
But I kept thinking of like watching it, you know, there's a little bit of a monster of the week aspect to the early episodes as various creatures and entities begin appearing. And I was telling my wife, I'm like, this reminds me a little of Eerie, Indiana, which was, for people who don't know, like an early 90s kids. It wasn't on Nickelodeon, but it was like a kid's Twilight Zone.
Twilight Zone, yeah.
Joe Dante helped it, yeah.
I did an episode of that. It was one of my favorite things.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to say, is you were the werewolf in
I was Idiot, the werewolf. In I think Erie, that, Indiana. And from what they told me, this was, what, 91 or 90, something really early 90s, and they said that was one of the first morphs on TV that wasn't in a film.
Oh,
it was one of the
your
first
transformation.
Morphs, yeah, into a werewolf, yeah. So
I was thinking of Erie, Indiana, and then, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer had the Hellmouth, which unleashed all these creatures on this little town.
Yeah.
You were the principal in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, handing out detentions.
Detention, detention, yes.
Yes.
Keep giving detentions to dead bodies, I remember that.
Exactly. There's a little bit of northern exposure. Of course, you're in northern exposure. We were saying it's like a middle-aged Scooby-Doo with the town workers. You've done Scooby-Doo. Like, Stephen, you've been training your whole life for Widow's Bay.
I have been. I have been. And I'm glad we got there because, man, I think like Barry, it's perfectly cast. It's got all these great character actors in it, Dale Dickey and Nancy Lanahan and Jeff Hiller. I mean, he's unbelievable. Everybody's great. There's a couple, as you know, Anthony, coming up, a couple of great actors coming up, but we're not supposed to say them yet.
No, no, we got to keep those a surprise. But,
it's great. I always learn something from those actors in that show. And Matthew is just insanely good. He can do just tiny comedy, big comedy. I've never seen a better frightened face than his.
Yeah.
He could pretty much do everything. He's amazing.
This show is it's created by Katie Dippold. She was a writer on Parks and Rec. Right before we started the show, I said, I was thinking of this as Parks and Rec if Stephen King wrote it, you know?
That's exactly true, because she used Widow's Bay as a spec script to get hired on Parks and Rec.
No kidding.
Yeah. Wow, so this script has been around for 10 years and more than that. Yeah, this idea. So she had this idea long ago. She's always loved horror. You're absolutely right that it's Parks and Rec-ish in some parts. But like in Barry, the drama doesn't mix with the comedy. The comedy comes from characters, but there's no mixing of the two. When it's horror, it's horror. And when it's, you know, comedy, it's character-driven, not a joke.
Right. I've seen people kind of talk about how there's a sweet spot from that, like, 1980s, the original Ghostbusters, where the horror is actually scary. Like, you see that cab driver in Ghostbusters, the skeletal cab driver. Like, that's legitimately
Or the library thing, yeah.
Or the library ghost. Ghost. Right. Scared shit out of me when I was a kid.
Me too.
Well, and people point to that as kind of like the ideal of the horror comedy, because
absolutely
it is something where the horror is treated well and the laughs are there and they come all from the characters. And I think that's something that Widow's Bay is hitting. And it's also, personally, for me, you know, I was kind of raised by the two Stevens, not the present company. I'm not revealing any paternity paperwork here,
Dad.
But I was raised by the two Stevens, and that's Stephen King and Steven Spielberg. And when obviously your character has so much Quint in it, and Jaws is my all-time favorite movie. And so when I saw that chocolate and peanut butter were going together in this, like, I, from the first moment, I'm just like, yeah, this show's for me. But I would love to talk to you about the Quintness of your character in particular.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you've got to wait a little bit into the series and we can talk more about it then.
Oh, okay. We got more Quintness coming up. But I mean, just from a writing perspective, your character's introduced in the same way that Robert Shaw's character in Jaws is, you know, where
absolutely.
He interrupts the big town meeting and, you know. And you know, I've seen you fire a harpoon gun already, so
yes, absolutely.
You know, so it
I
don't know.
Funny. Yeah, it was funny that we got we had shot that opening scene where you Wick is introduced, and Katie was rethinking it by the end of the series, saying, you know, we can introduce more characters maybe in that first scene than what we have in here right now. Mm-hmm. So the last scene that I shot was that first scene.
No kidding.
In the first episode. Yeah. Nice. So we reshot that just so we could introduce Dale Dickey's character and all those other guys. So you'd know them earlier.
You know, you started in horror. Is your first role Monkey Shines, the George Romero?
It is
movie?
My first real movie. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I think Romero's Night of the Living Dead, where the, you know, all these strangers get together. That influenced Stephen King. He has lots of stories like that where strangers get trapped together on a plane and in a grocery store. And it's sort of like what happens in a workplace. You're thrust together. It's like Office Space in a way, right? You get all these people who are, the only thing binding them is their employment. And in Widow's Bay, you have the same thing. You have a lot of people who probably wouldn't be friends in real life,
exactly.
But are thrust together.
Yeah, they are. And the fact that the island's so isolated, you know, there's not really Wi-Fi there. There's only, you know, landlines. And it's very, very insular. You know, most people haven't left the island. They've lived most of their lives on it. And that's a big part of the story.
What are your memories of working with Romero?
I remember I was kind of learning on the go. I had done, you know, many years of theater before this, mm-hmm. not a lot of TV or film stuff. And I remember very much doing a scene where somebody knocks on a door and I open it up and say who I am. And I kept opening up the door barely as the guy got his knuckle off of it. And like on the third take, he said, "Look, dude, just wait, give it a beat, wait like a normal human and open the door." So from then on, I was it was a lot easier, you know, because you get really nervous on the first time you're on a big set with a big director and blah, blah, blah. But I remember also walking up the steps with him to see the in the premiere, and he was pissed off because he really wanted a different ending to that thing so that he could have somewhat of a sequel. And I miss the scene where monkeys are licking my bleeding wounds. So yeah, that's what I remember about that.
Did actual monkeys have to do this?
Yes, yeah, I have a picture of it. I got a still from that scene with a monkey licking my bleeding forehead. So when I go, I'll send it to you.
Stephen, when you've worked in theater for years, you finally get a movie role. You're lying there with a monkey licking your forehead. Are you reconsidering acting at that point?
No, or are you like, yes? Best. No, it was very exciting to have a role in a big movie. And I got right after that, I got another fairly big movie at the time, which was the sequel to Crocodile Dundee, mm-hmm. Crocodile Dundee 2. Mm-hmm. And then I got Ghost after that. So yeah. It's like I'm thinking, well, I'm just going to have this lovely movie career. Of course, after that, I got nothing for many years and did a lot of TV.
But you knew how to wait to open a door. That was the thing.
I knew then that I had to start acting like a human being on camera as I would on stage, yes.
Right.
Thanks. Was there any licking that happened in Crocodile Dundee?
No, but there was a big knife about to cut my John Thomas off. So I
bring the monkeys back. I like that better.
Bring the monkeys back. They're not going to at least put a knife under there. So
we always like to talk to our guests about their Stephen King origin story. And were you a reader of his stuff, or when did you become aware of him?
I became a huge fan with The Stand. Mm-hmm. I think reading The Stand, because reading that book was like seeing the movie in your head, to me. Yeah. I mean, nothing scarier than going that tunnel scene and the squishing and it just frightened the hell out of me reading that book. And I was a fan after that. But I think that was probably my favorite for a while. I loved, you know, all the same ones everybody else loved. But that was really my beginning. I think my brother liked the vampire. What was the vampire movie?
Comes Salem's Lot.
Yeah, he was a big proponent of Salem's Lot. He loved that. But yeah, I was a Stand guy.
Do you remember why you picked it up? Was it just because that's what everybody was reading at the moment?
It was just a popular book at the time, and I can't remember whether it was a summer book, but it was. Frickin' big book.
Right. Now, tell me about it.
I don't know how many pages that book had, but that was probably the biggest book I'd read for a while, you know, because I was used to reading Marvel comics and then, you know, it'd take about 10 minutes.
Right.
But I loved it. I was always a reader. I was always a sci-fi guy. And that's, you know, that was kind of sci-fi to me. And so I probably got into it because I was a big, you know, Bradbury, Heinlein, and Clifford Simic, and all those guys. So into it because of that.
Then you'd end up being in your own Stephen King thing later. Yeah.
Yeah. How bizarre. It was fun to. I think in the audition, I did meet Stephen King. I think he was there looking at people. And I think I think he ended up as a bus driver or something.
He's the bus driver in Gold. Yeah, we should tell people. So. 1990, this in the wake of the It miniseries being a huge success.
Right.
This script that Stephen King had for a what we'd now call limited series, but which didn't exist back in those days. You had miniseries, which would be like maybe like a movie split into two parts or three parts. But he had an idea to do just one season. A story that's sort of a Benjamin Button type story, right? About an elderly.
Very much so, yeah. And what well before that, right?
Yeah. Well, I guess well after the F. Scott Fitzgerald short story, but well before the movie version.
Exactly.
I'm in a sweet spot there. But it's about a janitor who gets zapped. It's sort of like the Hulk, right? He gets zapped while working in a lab.
Yeah.
And starts aging backwards. Felicity Huffman is in it as well. She's like the young woman. Isn't she like an FBI agent?
She is. Yeah. This was before she married Bill, I think. Brenny Sternhagen, who I had worked with a few years before that, doing All My Sons in the Algonquin Circuit. So I knew Franny from that. I don't think I knew anybody else in the movie, but again, that was a big thing for me because it was a recurring role and something that would, you know, it was a good paycheck for me back in 1990, for sure.
And you played Major Moreland, a military guy who's trying to keep this this project under wraps. They're trying. It's sort of like The Fugitive in a way. Like this guy starts aging backwards, and then he and Francis Sternhagen go on the run. And tell us about Major Moreland.
Well, my audition for that was I have kind of a long. I'm telling this to somebody in one of the first couple episodes about a long monologue about when I was growing up, I had to eat stew every day, and we would eat it the first day, and then the second day it would get a little worse, third day was, and then I and by the end of the week I was eating just crap and really bad stuff. So my monologue was my audition piece for that, and how horrible it was eating week old stew every week. But yeah, he was kind of a nasty guy, and it was really fun to do him. Hadn't played that kind of a thing yet on TV.
It only lasted like 8 episodes, but I think he had like more to come. It was supposed to be like maybe twice that long.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea what was supposed to happen at the end of that series?
No, the ending was supposed to be tremendously bad. I can't remember what it was. But it was supposed to have a second season because they were real big on it. And then it just didn't do very well because people didn't, understand what a miniseries was, you know, like you said at the time. And they were like, well, this is weird. And then they watched 2 and then they were gone. So... the network just said, no, that's enough, and let it go. Mm-hmm. I remember it coming out on DVD, and it was like maybe 6 DVDs, something like that. And then, not DVDs, but VHSs. Mm-hmm. And then it came out as a DVD, as a 4-hour movie. So they cut it up again. So that's I think, the last iteration of it that I've heard of.
I was trying to look up what Stephen King has said about that show, and I found a long article that he wrote, first person narrative, in 1990 in Entertainment Weekly, where he just talks about the whole process. And he mentions at one point, I'll just read this quick part here. He goes, in 1982, when a TV production company offered me my own program, as the company visualized it, every week I would introduce a different story of New England horror, a kind of Down East Twilight Zone, if you like, where the girl would say, do you get the feeling something strange is going on around here, Jed? To which Jed would reply, yeah. And I thought, Stephen, he says, I turned the offer down, but they kept coming back at me about a dozen times. But then I proposed this Golden Years story. And I was just thinking, is something strange going around here, Jed? And Jed going, oh yeah? Wick is Jed. This Wick show has finally happened.
It just took a while. I'm sure Katie would say that's absolutely true, that all these things are elements of what's in Widow's Bay now. But it is somehow transmogrified into a really an original take on horror. And even though everybody's part of it. Everything that you've ever watched is a part of it. It's still an original thing, I think, and that's a tribute to Katie and how well she writes.
Tell us about Wick and what you, Eric already said, there's a bit of Quint in him. I see a little bit of Judd Crandall from Pet Sematary in him, the old guy who knows all the secrets of the island. Right. There's a little bit of Chicken Little in him because he's trying to warn people and nobody wants to hear it. Mm-hmm. Tell us what you put into him. Well, you want to make him more than a character or more than a spoof.
I think he feels like he is the protector of the town, you know, and even though nobody's listening to him, as well they shouldn't, he's the town drunk, he feels a responsibility to the town, and here's this guy coming in and saying, no, let's bring more people and kids and fun. It's like, no, let's not do that, because you have no idea what this island is about and what it's been about for not just your lifetime, but for centuries, literally centuries. And it's the island really is a character unto itself, as you'll find out later, more about the island. And will you find out about why these things are happening? Maybe, maybe not. But the island itself is definitely a character in this movie, and he feels like he has to protect these people from the island. So that's kind of his main mission and goal. And so his conflict is with the mayor, Matthew Reese's part.
Mm. Now you get to play around with tone a bit here, and that we were talking a little bit about that mixture of horror and comedy. But I'll give an example. As we're recording this, the third episode is out. And in that episode, the monster of the week of that episode is a sea hag thing. And there is a moment where a recliner is used, the comfy dad chair is used in a way that is almost like Abrams level spoof movie kind of thing. But it works within the way that the tone is set up here.
Script. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're saying. And when I read that script, that made me laugh so hard because I'm the one who says in there, well, so what does this hag do? Well, she gets up on your bed and sits on your face.
Yeah.
It's like, what? What do you mean she sits on your face? The fact that they used that chair to fling her off just made me so happy, cry happy.
It is so funny.
But it works. It's comedy that worked within the midst of a horrendous hag coming to frickin' tear you apart.
Yeah.
So that's
and sit on some faces.
To me. Yeah, it's amazing to me that that works. But that is the line that she has walked throughout this thing, and it gets slimmer and slimmer as we go along.
As you heard at the top of the show, this week's sole sponsor is Hokum, Damian McCarthy's most unnerving horror yet. It's now available on digital. It's from the director of Oddity. If you've seen that one, you know you're in for a good time. Hokum stars Adam Scott in a deeply monstrous horror film that Fangoria says is scary enough to make seasoned viewers jump. We have to talk about this for a second, because that's not just hyperbole. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know how he does it, but director Damian McCarthy has a very special talent for creating tension. If you've seen Oddity, you know I'm not just bullshitting you because this is the ad copy in front of me. There's a jump scare in that movie that got me so good. It involves a digital camera and a perfect misdirect. I don't know how he does it, but he's somehow able to film a jump scare that is super effective without feeling cheap. And you know what I mean when I say cheap. That's usually in those like Friday the 13th movies where the cat jumps out of the cabinet and a bunch of pots fall on the ground or some shit. He doesn't rely on going very quiet and then popping a loud sound effect out of nowhere to get you. He carefully crafts his tense moments, so when the scare actually happens, you kind of feel good about how he got you. Again, the dude's very talented at this, and the trend continues in Hokum. It's one of my favorite genre flicks of the year, and I must say it was very smart of the ad team to book this particular title for the KingCast, because Hokum is so Stephen King-coded, I'm sure it's going to appeal to any of our constant reader audience. I mean, it's about a lovably dickish writer spending time in a creepy backwoods hotel. You know, that's very much Stephen King's territory. Adam Scott is great in the flick. There's surprising twists and turns. The whole vibe is just totally my shit. Don't miss Hokum, the groundbreaking new folk horror film from Damien McCarthy. Rent or buy it everywhere you get your movies. Stranger Things ending didn't end the run of Stephen King-inspired greatness for our viewing pleasure. So go check out Hokum when you get a chance. And now let's get back to our chat with Mr. Stephen Root. Is it a little freeing for you to tackle a character knowing that you have a little bit more, you know, freedom to maybe push beyond, you know, a grounded reality at times, you know, more restrictive, do you think?
No, I think I would agree with Matthew when he says we're not playing a drama or horror or a comedy show. We're just playing reality. We're playing for real. And if some comedy comes out of it, okay, but it has to come from the character itself. You got to play it strictly for real, or it's not gonna work. So everybody is going for a very realistic take of it, and funny shit happens when you're in a bizarre situation.
That's true.
You know, but as long as it comes from the character and from the grounded story, that's okay.
It's also like a byproduct of bringing these like olden times legends into the modern era, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and actually, you know, being able to use a recliner to yeet a sea witch off of you is not necessarily a joke that I think Stephen King would write that joke. He would do
absolutely.
That. I mean, that's kind of what his, you know, what launched him into superstardom was with Salem's Lot.
Sure.
You know, and Carrie both, they were very modern tales at the time, but Salem's Lot in particular was him pulling the vampires out of the Dracula castle and putting them into a neighborhood that you recognize, you know,
that's putting a bizarre situation into a normal place.
Right.
And that happens in a lot of shows now. I mean, Stranger Things and everything else. So, you know.
And one I kept thinking of, I don't know if you know this book, Stephen, but he wrote Needful Things. I think it was around the time Golden Years was coming out, like 1990, 92 or so.
Okay, I remember the title. I don't remember the book.
But it's about Castle Rock, his sort of prototypical small New England town. And the devil comes to town and opens a little consignment shop, and he sells people objects that they have to pay for with a prank. And it leads to the town turning against each other. He gets everybody playing these little mean little pranks on each other that become feuds, that become blood feuds.
Right.
And I interviewed him once about it, and he said, you know, it got bad reviews because people didn't understand that it's meant to be funny. It's meant to be a dark comedy, and they only wanted the scares from me. And I think sometimes horror people only want comedy, and comedy people don't want things to be too scary. It's a really hard thing to balance. Is it something you guys talk about when you were shooting Widow's Bay? Like, okay, you're playing it too big, dial it back, or actually play it bigger. Let's play this more for laughs.
Right. No, I hear your point. I think in anything like this, when you're treading a line so thin that you've got to do either the big take and the lesser take and the nothing take. And we did that pretty much with most of the stuff, because as in film and in TV, it becomes an editor's medium, ultimately, you know, and the creator and the director are looking at that as they make the tone. So they've got choices, you know. Sometimes we can use the bigger takes, you know, where, you know, the comedy makes sense but sometimes you have to use the straight on really small stuff. I remember I have some line in one of them where I say I don't want to go tit for tit with you. and the reaction shot that Hiro Murai, who's a brilliant director, and Katie used was just an eye flick from Matthew and Kate, just that's wrong, but okay, let's keep going.
Yeah, so, we're not going to die on that hill.
Yeah, so really great comedy within a tenth of a second and you're gone, you know, and it has to be that small. So you have to give the director and the editor and the author choices, and that's our job as actors.
Do you have much say over the look of Wick, of this this sort of grizzled fisherman? Do you get to weigh in on that much?
They originally, when I got cast, they said pleadingly, "Can you grow facial hair?" And I said, "Dudes, it's COVID. It's after COVID. I have a huge frickin' beard. Don't worry about it." So I just, at that point, it wasn't huge at that point. I cut it down, but I just let it grow until we started shooting and let it grow all the way through the 4-month process that we did. So it's fairly big at the end.
Yeah. Are you even a grizzled fisherman if you don't have a bunch of scruff on your face?
Yeah, you got to have it. You got to have scruff as a fisherman. It has to happen. You have to have a cap. The one I pitched, the one that I had in my closet, and of course they wouldn't use it, but it's a camouflage hat, and it says, hang on 1 second. It has it's two words on the top of this camouflage hat, and it says "Master Bait." But they wouldn't let me wear it.
Fishermen would find that hilarious.
Exactly. And that's my character. I said, come on, he would wear it. He'd think it's funny. But no, it's all right.
A guy like Wick, also, the look of him suggests somebody who doesn't have any formal occasions to attend in the near future.
No, never would. Have you seen his truck? It's from 1956. I'm sorry about this horn out here, guys. There's nothing I can do.
Are you jacking the car while we're?
I'm on 59th Street in New York, and that's where we are. His whole, even his house, which you eventually see in this, you know, place. I think you see it in episode 3.
Mm-hmm.
Is very, very pedestrian, and that's how he's lived his life. You find a little bit more about Wick's backstory in the upcoming episodes, which is nice. So you're not seeing just the crusty old fisherman; you're seeing an actual human being. So I'm looking forward to people seeing that.
Now, when we, you know, were first talking about with the Apple folks about having you on the show, we were like, okay, what Stephen King thing do you think you'd like to talk about? And we heard back that 11/22/63 was one of your favorite.
Yeah,
King stories. Would you call that your favorite King book?
Almost, because I'm a big time travel sci-fi guy. I love time travel books, and this certainly is one. I thought the miniseries was really well done, but I love the book. And he, you know, so the stuff he's written, like Shawshank and Misery, and that stuff that fits in that world to me. That hit all the buttons for me. That had everything that I wanted in it. I thought it was great.
I think my favorite thing about that book is just the way that he gives definitive rules to this thing. It's not an easy time travel. He doesn't have Jake Epping doesn't have a DeLorean where he can just go whenever he wants, at any point. It's not an easy thing for him to go and dedicate, because this wormhole that takes him back in time doesn't take him to the day before the Kennedy assassination. You know, he has to spend years.
Yeah, yes. He's got a cool as he
yes.
You know,
it's, there are impediments.
Yeah. Yes.
If you're trying to change time, which is fantastic. Mm-hmm. No, I loved all those rules. And the fact that, you know, he's completing his friend's mission. He's trying to at any rate. And I loved what he did with that book and stuck to his stuck to his rules within the writing, and that was just fabulous to me.
It's the kind of thing that you need in a story like this, because it when you're dealing with time travel, the thing that's always the killer with it is like, well, if you have the ability to travel through time, you can make as many mistakes as you want, right? Because then you can just keep going back and correcting it. But that's not the case here. He has a couple of shots at most, right? And and I also kind of love, you know, not to, maybe we won't get super duper spoilery about this, even though it's an older book at this point, but I do love that it's such a ginormous book and you're with Jake this whole time. You're falling in love with him. You're falling in love with his relationship with the teacher. And like you're doing, you know, you're so invested in it and invested in it as the world literally is working against him to, you know, to stop him from stopping the Kennedy assassination, because that's just how time is. It doesn't want to be changed. Right. Like, I love that you're with him that whole time. And then you get to the resolution of the book and you realize the way King goes is he could have made it like, yes, everybody's right. It's a utopia. Everything's great. You know, it's a good act spawned a catastrophic future. And I love that that King makes you invested that entire time and brings you along on this huge book to do this, to get to that moment where you're like, fuck. Like, this isn't what we wanted out of this thing.
Right. You know? But like in anything, in any book or in any movie or any TV, if you're invested in the characters, then that's everything. You have to like the characters to continue reading about them and want to know what happens to them. And that's
for sure.
That's the same in Widow's Bay. You get invested in the characters and you want to know, well, what the hell happened to this guy or that woman, you know?
So, fellas, I was just in Dallas about a week ago, and I got a free morning, and I went to the Texas School Book Depository building, which now is a museum dedicated to the assassination, and the sixth floor where Oswald shot from the window is, it was such a moving experience to stand there and look out the window. I don't know if either of you have ever visited.
I haven't, no.
Yeah, I did. It was like mandatory for middle schoolers in Texas to go to the
pilgrimage down there. So.
Visit the X on the road where the
Yeah, you
the
can
shot
look out
happened.
The window and see the X where the shot happened, the two shots happened. I found it was a really beautiful museum, and then the seventh floor is dedicated all to the journalism. But then when I came downstairs, I walked through the gift shop. And here, I don't know if you guys can see this, but there's the book, 11/22/63, Stephen King's novel.
Wow.
For sale in the Texas School Book Depository.
That's great.
Which was so bizarre, I had to take a picture of it, and I sent it to King and said, hey, Steve, I just thought you'd like to know, your book is for sale here in this museum. you know, the movie JFK that Oliver Stone directed is not for sale there, and all I can think is Stephen King's time travel story is considered more historically accurate
than that movie. I think most things are.
It's a great movie, but maybe not so accurate. But it's wild to me that, you know, that they have you know, they've got lots of JFK paraphernalia and history books about the subject, but the one that they have on display on the table is Stephen King's novel. And
That's so funny.
You know, I did feel like I got to know the town of Dallas in the early 60s through that town, because that character, Jake Epping, goes and he lives there. He lives on those streets and gets to know those people.
Well, I was a kid in the 50s and early 60s, you know. I was born in 51, so I was pretty cognizant by the end of, you know, 58 when this starts. And all that resonated with me very much, much so, all the small town stuff, because I was a Midwest kid born in 51. I was 8 or 9, you know, when all this stuff was taking place in 58 and through 63. I remember walking up the hill in Sioux City, Iowa, and somebody was, I was from lunch. Somebody was walking down the hill and said, President Kennedy's been shot. And I went, that's funny. And I kept walking, you know, because nobody believed it for the first 10 or 20 minutes. And after that, it was just a cry fest in my school. you know, mostly the teachers.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember all that stuff so well, and all the small town drugstores and mm-hmm. all that stuff that's not here anymore. It's not doesn't exist.
Yeah, my stepdad, his birthday is November 22nd, and he would get so visibly angry every time his birthday was rolling around, because there was always like, okay, now here's the special in remembrance of on TV, and like, you know,
yeah.
And that brought up all this trauma as a kid, where he's like, I'm going to go to school and celebrate my birthday, and everybody's crying at school instead that day, so...
No, I get you. I'm my brother's the 19th. I'm the 17th of November. So
oh.
always comes up around that time.
It's like being born close to Christmas.
Yeah.
Shitty Christmas. All right. Brez, what
one of the things that was interesting at that museum was that they one of their displays was all about the political tensions around the world at the time. You know, mm-hmm. you think about the Cold War, that.
The Cuban crisis, yeah,
yeah, all that the was Cuban happening. Missile crisis. The notion that one man's bullet could potentially be the tiny domino that knocks over a bigger domino that knocks over a bigger domino yeah. that leads to two countries with nuclear weapons unleashing them on each other. That was a real possibility. And again, we don't have to get into the spoilers of 11/22/63, but what Jake finds is that, oh, actually, maybe things could be worse yeah. than what actually yeah. happened.
Oh, I remember shelters, you know, there were shelters for bomb shelters for that in the early 60s. I mean, people, they would have drills even in New York City where the streets would empty, people go into the bomb shelters. So bizarre.
The duck and cover.
The death of a president could lead to like the end of the world.
Absolutely.
If cooler heads had not prevailed in the midst of that crisis. So, you know, I think King actually captured something real about history and the notion that things could always be worse.
Absolutely.
The argument for, you know, the guy that runs the diner that's been trying to fix this for a while, you know, he gets you to believe that stuff too, because he talks about this one moment, you know, without JFK dying, RFK probably doesn't get assassinated, and MLK right. probably doesn't get assassinated. But, you know, there's also the realities of, you know, that assassination is, you know, the Voting Rights Act wouldn't have gotten passed without it. It was so stalled out until right. the goodwill of the people, you know, from coming off of this. It's like, what are the unintended good consequences of a bad act? What are the unintended consequences that turn out terrible of a good act? Right. And I.
Sure. You might have not had LBJ, you know,
right.
Foster that act. You know, yeah. which was a huge thing, even though it was kind of gutted, but it was still the start of something amazing.
Yeah.
So that couldn't have happened, maybe.
Getting back to that theme of humor and terror being interlinked, I also like that King uses the story to show, I forget the diner's owner, he's played by Chris Cooper in the mm-hmm. miniseries, but
yeah,
the exactly. diner owner also uses his portal into the past to buy cheap food and goods.
That's why
the big mystery on campus, right?
Is buck,
how
right?
does he keep his
exactly.
burgers?
That was hysterical. Love yeah. that.
You keep know, his burgers
funny. Yeah. They reissued that. I think that series debuted on Hulu, and then it recently like shifted to Netflix, and Netflix
okay.
began promoting it.
Yeah, right.
And so a bunch of people who are too young, like my daughter is 16 now. And I think when that first came out, it had to be about 6 years ago, right, Eric? So she was just a little
at
kid.
Least. Yeah.
Yeah. When that first came out, so she didn't know about it. And she discovered it like a lot of kids. It became this phenomenon just mm-hmm. in the past few months on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, I'm watching this show. I think Stephen King wrote it. I'm like, oh, what is it? She goes, it's about a guy who goes into a closet and brings that back meat. I'm like, what? Yeah, he goes into a closet and he brings back meat for his diner. I'm like, what the fuck story
what are you
is she
talking about? Yeah.
Oh, he goes back and I'm like, oh right, it's 11/22. She didn't mention the JFK thing at all. I don't think she realized. I think she only seen the first episode.
Very funny. That's great. Yeah, no, that was great. So yeah, that's one of the reasons. That just hit all my buttons. The time travel, the sci-fi aspect of it, the horror of it, with, you know, the guy that keeps coming up to him and saying, "Don't do that."
Yeah,
the yellow ticket man or whatever his
name
is.
The yellow ticket guy. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was all tremendous, and I give him every credit for that. And certainly, that kind of tone is used in Widow's Bay.
As a guy who loves time travel stories too, did that add a little extra thrill to The Man in the High Castle for you?
Sure. Yeah, it did. I was really happy to get on that show, because they talk about in the first season the man in the high castle, but he's never seen.
Yeah.
And I think I show up in episode one of the second season, and I was thrilled to go into that, because I thought that was a fantastic concept. And then you've got just great actors in that, mm-hmm. as well. And it went, of course, well beyond the book, as did, Game of Thrones, because it just, the filming was going faster than the author. And the book originally for Man in the High Castle is very, you know, it's very short, but I think they did a great job with that. I was thrilled to be in a time travel thing or an other dimension show. You know, because that's hits all my sci-fi buttons.
Right.
That's one of the things that time travel is really great at, is reframing your perspective, like reconsidering paths not taken. One of my favorite moments in that show is when the woman from the Japanese territory from the west coast of the U.S. is being tutored by the young Nazi when she escapes to the east. And he's teaching her about the American genocide. And she's like, "What? America didn't commit a genocide." And he goes, "Oh, did you not hear about the Native Americans?" And you realize, oh,
hello. Yeah.
Interesting.
That's
interesting.
Real life right there.
We don't really teach it that way, do we? Mm-hmm. But
no, we don't. And certainly not when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Any history book that from the 50s and early 60s is it's a lot of fiction in there.
Yeah. You know, we're the good guys. And interesting when you consider how somebody else might view something, or if things had turned a different way, how the victor doesn't always write the history, I guess.
Right. Exactly. So, yeah, love that. Love that stuff. And, you know.
Stephen, would you have been radicalized by that diner owner to have given up 5 years of your life to go do this? Do you think he could have been talked into if you were in Jake Epping's position? Would you have given up everything in your life to go try to make the world a better place in this particular way?
Yeah, I think it would depend on what age I was at the time. Right. As an older guy, nope. As a younger guy, maybe, yeah. Because I feel like in my 20s, early 20s, I would welcome that adventure. I mean, just becoming an actor was an adventure. You know, there's really no reason to become one to make a living, because you probably won't. You know, 95% of us don't work very often. But if you have to do it, you have to do it. I was adventurous.
You know, Stephen, what you could do is you go back in time.
Yeah.
You find young Stephen Root walking home from school. You say, "Listen, kid, you're going to reach a point where you're lying on the ground and a monkey is licking your forehead. Don't worry. Keep going. You're going to have a great career. You're going to be in every movie and TV show. It's going to be a good run. Don't let that monkey get you down.
Don't worry about the monkey. You just worry about the paycheck and whether or not you'll get a job right after that," which I did. Yeah, I think as a younger guy, I would have taken the challenge. I think as an older guy, when you finally have family and kids and responsibilities, maybe not.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jake's in a very specific spot in his life where he's newly divorced, right? And if I remember the story correctly, and he's just like, as isolated as you could be in his time, where he's in a position where he could like give up what he has and you know, right. and try to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But, absolutely. But,
and brings us a world of future bucks or whatever the hell Stephen King wrote about about there.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us here on the KingCast. I know we've had a great time talking to you about Widow's Bay. Everybody, if you love Stephen King stuff, you got to check out Widow's Bay. This is right up your alley, and Stephen is wonderful in it, as he is in almost everything I can think of. So thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much, guys. You have a great show, and it's nice to really, really celebrate somebody as great as he is, and I'll remain a fan forever.
Ladies and gentlemen, the great Stephen Root. Many thanks to him and the publicity team behind Widow's Bay for making this happen. The show rules. He rules. Go watch it. I'm pretty sure the season finale is airing this week, so now's the perfect time to binge if you haven't dived in. I don't know English very well, but you know what I mean. Now's the time to visit this fantastic show on Apple TV. It's funny, creepy stuff. Go watch it. You'll love it. Hope you all enjoyed this episode. I know I did. Again, big fan of Stephen Root over here, and he was delightful. As usual, if you dig the show and you want to directly support it, the very best way is to sign up for our Patreon and get access to hundreds of bonus episodes ranging from special interviews, commentary tracks, and our own actual play D&D adventure series. We also got mailbags. We have one coming up where it's a catch-up episode where you find out what Brez and I have been doing over the last few weeks. You know, I've been sitting on my ass playing Magic the Gathering and watching movies and TV shows, but he's been on like a legit African safari. You're gonna hear all about that and more over at patreon.com/thekingcast. Again, that's the best way to directly support the show. Second best way is to share love on social media, tell a friend, tweet about it, blue sky about it, leave a review. We appreciate all the support and appreciate you guys for listening to the show. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next one. Until then, adios, folks. The KingCast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late, great Scott Wampler. We'll